And welcome to
Killing It
on Broadway. I'm Jennifer Simard.
And I am Jessica Vosk, and this is the podcast where we discuss all things guts, gore, murder, and mayhem.
It's not safe for work. Hi, Jessica.
Hi, Jennifer.
And hi, Anne Harada.
Hi.
And we are so happy that you are here with us today. Thank you so, so much for taking the time to be here.
Thank you so much, like Jess said. You do have an incredible, storied, amazing career. Today, we're not here to talk about that. I'm afraid we don't care. Sorry.
No, I don't really care either, frankly.
Great. We're all on
the same
page.
You know, this is why... Now you understand why we have guests like Anne, because all we truly do care about is true crime. And we are fascinated. Jen and I are both, we are both fascinated by true crime. We know a ton of our colleagues are fascinated by true crime too. And so all this time I sit to myself, I don't know if you feel this way, Anne, I sit and I'm like, am I a serial killer? Because all I do is listen to documentaries about killings. Are my friends serial killers? Anne, are you a serial killer? Are we Ted Bundy? What's our fascination with it? So Anne, are you very interested in true crime? And if you are, when did you become interested in true crime?
Okay. I read Helter Skelter when I was a young girl, and it totally turned into my favorite book, which is horrifying. And when we took a family vacation to California, I made my father drive me past the scene of the crime.
My hands went in the air, like touchdown. That's exactly what
like
happened.
So creepily. I don't know why. I mean, I just think it's, you know, we're actors, so it's interesting to us to get into other people's heads. And there's, you know, to me, a serial killer is like so unfathomable. Like, whenever I respond to something, I never think, you know, I should cut somebody's head off and maybe eat the brains out and put it in the freezer or whatever. You know what I mean? Whatever their thing is. Like, it never occurs to me.
And you just answered our follow-up question, which is, you know, do you have any theories of why actors like true crime? But as a second follow-up, were you part of the Manson family? Is that what you're telling us here today?
No, I was not. I don't find that look attractive. Mm-hmm. That's me. That's just me. Mm-hmm. I'm not that crazy about facial hair on, like, you know, skinny guys who play guitar. I know I'm sort of not in the mainstream of that thinking, but
no, I'm with you.
So no,
although
that's
I will
not gonna
say,
happen.
I'm going to say Helter Skelter. I also have a fascination with it. I have a fascination with everything that happened in California with it. So
yeah,
that must just be something that all of us true crime fanatics are, that we freak out about. I'm currently reading a book right now about one of the family members from
You are.
Charles
Which
Manson.
One?
Diane Lake? Yeah, she wrote a book and it's about her experience.
Was she Diane something else before?
I think so.
Is that her married name or something? She changed her name because she was Diane something else before.
Yes, and she was so young when it happened, and her family kind of let her go off Manson. And oh my God, it's like this behind the scenes version of what family life was like there. And I just think to myself, to be a fly on the wall before all of that shit went down.
Jessica, Jess, we talk 72 times a day. I did not know you were reading this. This is great to know. I love this.
Yeah. Well, and I don't know, whenever nobody has mentioned Helter Skelter to us.
No.
I have such a fascination with somebody who, and like Anne said, we're actors. We can inhabit other people's emotions because we're such empaths. But you think of this guy who was able to create basically like a religion for people.
Right.
And he didn't actually commit the murders, like to manipulate other people into doing it. That's a whole different kind of evil genius, right?
I think so.
Ooh.
It's like being the head of, you know, Scientology or whatever.
Yeah.
If you're talking people into a whole cult kind of, you know, thing, that's, I think, more evil probably than just like, I'm going to take a knife and cut that pregnant woman up, whatever.
Y'all, tell me the name of that movie. Did you see that movie with Brad Pitt where he won his Oscar about the alternative?
Oh, yeah. No, I wanted to
What's
see
the name of it.
This is so typical. Me and my husband were like, when we can never get away to like watch this movie together, we might have to go one at a time. It was sort of like one of those kinds of issues. And it just never happened.
Well, I think knowing that you made a specific trip to go see the site.
Oh
no,
God.
That you're like us. You're one of us.
You're one of us. Thank God you're one of us, Anne. I thought I was the only one.
And it's called Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. That's the name of the movie. Check it out. I think you would really, I mean, for lack of a better word, enjoy it as much as one can enjoy that. But it's, yeah, I really did. I think it's a very good film. Now, Anne, you are from Hawaii, yes?
I sure am.
And in our research, we see that you and Barack Obama, who is 3 years older than you, both attended Punahou High School. So we're wondering, A, did you know him? And B, did you date?
Okay. As I've said many times, he was 2 years ahead of me in school. Mm-hmm. He was class of 79. I was class of 81. Unlike the plot of High School Musical, people on the basketball team did not interact with people in the theater department.
Damn it.
So we were not friends. We had no, you know, connection there. And then my mother worked with his grandmother at the Bank of Hawaii, and they were friends. So my mother was a very early adopter of Barack Obama, the politician, and told me to like read up on him, and he was going to go someplace. And, you know, she was right. How about that?
Wow. That's
amazing. So you went to school together at the same time.
We did. We shared, yes, the campus at the same time.
Did I pronounce the school correctly?
Punahou.
Punahou. I pronounced it incorrectly. Punahou. I said Punahou. Punahou.
Who cares?
Oh, Jennifer. I care.
Oh, thanks, Jennifer. Anne. Well, I don't know. I think moms know sometimes, don't they? I hate to admit that. I hate to admit that. I'm just saying, if my mom is going to listen to this, I hate to admit that. Jen, cut it out. But moms know. Moms know, I have to say. So when your mom was like, look out for this guy, she made the right move.
Right. She really did. Yeah.
But speaking of Punahou.
Punahou.
So our case is related directly to the Punahou school where you and our boyfriend Barack went to school. And I know that you and Jen have been in touch about this. And between the two of you, the three of us now, I am very schniddly-do excited / sad that we are going to relay and discuss the tragic kidnapping and murder of George Gill Jameson.
Now, and when we were in touch about this case, you said you had heard of it and that it's topical. And I agree that it's topical. And I think I know one reason why, but I'd like to play a game with you. I'm going to give you some multiple choice answers about why I think it might be topical. And just please give me your best guess, okay? Is it topical because of A, racism, B, racism, C, racism, or D, all of the above?
All of the above.
And get your bathing suit ready. You've just won the all expense paid trip to Honolulu in 2K2K.
Mm-hmm. And by all expense paid, we mean a virtual trip to Hawaii here on Zoom. So, Anne, I just need you to relax, you know, lie back in your virtual chaise lounge. Your waitress, Jessica, is going to bring you a virtual fruity drink.
I have waitressed in the past. I want you to know that I waitressed through college. So when I butcher these Hawaiian words, just feel free to correct us, Anne, because I'm not drunk, but I might sound.
I understand. They're hard. Some of them are hard.
Well, yeah. Why do they have to, you pronounce every vowel usually? Is that right?
I would say that's true. Yes, as a rule.
Now, before we begin, credit where credit's due. We got a lot of our information from old newspaper articles, including the Honolulu Star Bulletin, the Pittsburgh Post Gazette, the San Jose Evening News, United Press, Downwind Productions, Roland Kodun's The Japanese in Hawaii, A Century of Struggle, Densho Encyclopedia, findagrave.com, hawaiipublicradio.org, and Professor Jonathan Okamura's book, Race to Death in 1920s Hawaii. This is the story of 10-year-old George Gill Jameson and his convicted assailant, 19-year-old Yutaka Miles Fukunaga.
So, imagine you're a teenager and your parents are abjectly poor and you want to help out the family. So in addition to your schoolwork and editing your school paper and the virtues of being very kind to animals, you in your copious spare time, obviously pick up a few shifts at a local hotel to help the family out. And by pick up a few shifts, I'm going to say a solid 80 hours a week in the kitchen pantry of a local hotel. Anne, have you ever worked in a hotel?
No, I've worked in a restaurant. That's it.
I don't think I've ever worked in a hotel either, but so
I just sang in a hotel.
Yes, sung at hotels. I've changed clothes and bathrooms at hotels, you know, that sort of thing.
I think the three of us know the Marriott Marquis as a place in New York City where we could go and absolutely change our clothes from audition to audition. Oh,
yeah.
Absolutely.
Totally. Yeah. Oh yeah.
Boy, does it take me back. So you're this teen, you're shy. One might say that you are antisocial, a little bit depressed. So much so that you attempt to commit suicide twice. Both times you fail, but the attempts do succeed at embarrassing your conservative Japanese-American family. So in addition to all of this at school, you and your culture are essentially being whitewashed at every turn, and your parents, who owe $20 for 1 month's late back pay of rent, are about to be evicted. You, as this teen, are looking to escape, and you are looking to escape like any of us are trying to escape the Coco Roro as we speak. And you start losing yourself by diving into reading anything and everything you can get your hands on about the pair of wacky sociopathic murderers, Leopold and Loeb.
Yeah, those guys. What a riot. 4 years earlier, Leopold and Loeb made headlines in Chicago and across the country by murdering 14-year-old Bobby Franks purely as a thrill kill, you know, just to see what it felt like. What a great pair of guys. Now, Yutaka, we're going to call him Miles from now on because that is the name he went by. He closely followed the Leopold and Loeb case and unfortunately was inspired by them to commit the perfect crime. Now, keep this in mind. Miles had on his own, A bit of a death wish, and B, he wanted to provide his parents with money so they could go back to Japan, which was actually their heart's desire. He bore resentment toward Frederick Jameson, who worked for the bank that, as we mentioned, was about to evict the family from Miles' home. So Miles sought out Frederick Jameson's 10-year-old son, Gil, to exact his revenge. On the morning of September 18th, 1928, Miles put on a white jacket, presumably one that he wore from his pantry job, in an attempt to resemble a hospital orderly. He goes to the Punahou school and fabricates a story that Gil's mother had been in a car accident and that Gil needed to come with him immediately. So away Gil goes with him in a taxi and is essentially at this point successfully kidnapped. Miles then takes him to a predetermined spot in Waikiki and murders him immediately by bludgeoning him with a steel chisel. Though some reports do say the child was strangled. Only after the boy was dead, Miles sends a note to Gil's parents demanding $10,000, which is about $142,000 today, in exchange for the safe return of the boy. Miles then calls Frederick, Gil's dad, personally to set up a meeting and exchange the money. Miles, wearing a disguise and carrying a hammer, meets Gil's dad, receives $4,000 from him, which is about $60,000 in today's money, promises that he'll safely return Gil, but then Miles takes off, never to be seen again into the night. Unbeknownst to Frederick, Gil was already dead.
A hammer?
Like, well, I think it went wrong. Tell me. Like,
yeah, and talk about it. Tell.
Why $4,000? Oh, actually, I know why. Because he got nervous and he just took what was given to him. Like, they didn't count it. Do you know
what I mean? That would make sense. He's so young.
That's a lot of money. Well, you're saying because the dad was wealthy, presumably, and he only brought $4,000. But you know, like those old Hollywood movies where there's this kind of exchange of money. It's like, I'm going to need 24 hours. You know, like you need more time to get your hands on that kind of large
amount of money.
You know, amount of money. So I'm sure
but he worked at the bank.
That's a great question. So did he cheap
what's
out?
What's the disguise? Why the hammer?
I used the word disguise. It was just like one of the COVID cloths that you have across your face. What do you call those?
Bandana things.
The bandanas. Yes, I know. Yeah, he had kind of like a bandana. And I guess, A, he didn't want to be recognized, and B, a weapon just in case things went south, right?
These are bad weapons. You're going to try to kill somebody with a chisel?
Isn't that
hideous?
It feels
like it would take so long. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, God, Anne.
Do you know? But like, if like, trying to kill a mouse in my bathroom with a magazine, it takes a really long time, and it's not pleasant for either one of us.
You make a good point.
Do you know what I'm saying? And it's like, here, little boy, I'm just going to whack you in the head a bunch. Like, this doesn't seem like the most effective way to kill somebody, especially if you're trying not to attract attention.
Exactly.
Very fair. That is a very fair point.
So weird. So weird.
Anne, what are you drinking? What are you drinking over there, Anne? Oh, iced tea. Iced tea. All right. I'm just, I'm going to pretend it's your little virtual imaginary pina colada.
Okay.
So, because what else do we have this year? What else do we have? So I don't mean to segue from like exact all of this weird shit that we're talking about of why would you even, this person makes no sense. Obviously they did this without any real, you know, not that you want to have research done on how to kill somebody properly. However, this person, like, no, thank you, sir. But I want to talk about the racism because, it's where it starts to rear its ugly head right here. So the local, and you tell me if I'm don't pronounce this right. Haole, white upper class society. Is that how I pronounce that? Haole.
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 Okay. The local Haole, which is a white upper class society. They're completely shocked by the crime. They dozens of reports emphasize the quote, Oriental, phrasing on the ransom note. Many Japanese American men were racially profiled about the kidnapping, including Harry Kaizan, who was Frederick Jameson's former chauffeur and was literally beaten by police to force a confession. I feel like this happens a lot.
I was going to say, and this is different from how now. Like, right? It's the same. It's, you know, what's weird about the whole construct is that then as now, Asians are the biggest segment of the population of Hawaii. Okay.
Yeah.
But when the colony, whatever, was formed and like the government was formed, it was all the rich white guys, the people who owned like the plantations and the factories and the shipping, you know, whatever, all these industries that go into Hawaii, they became like the elite. Right? The upper class, white people. I'm like, for why? We're in Hawaii. You know, we Hawaiians and like people from every country in the world came to Hawaii to like work in the fields and make money. Like you know, that's how my family came over. They came over as like laborers, you know, like farm laborers. And they worked in the pineapple fields or, you know, that sort of cane fields, that sort of thing. One of my grandmothers was a picture bride. She came over to marry a guy and, you know, they needed wives and they sent back to Japan for like anybody willing to come to Hawaii, you know, that kind of a thing.
Wow.
Yeah.
Jessica, like, you could do that. You could do that, Jess.
I do it all the time. I if anybody wants to marry, I'm ready. Period.
Okay.
But I mean, that's amazing. The thing that you're saying, Anne, it is. It's so amazing to me. You're going, why?
I was reading that they said a lot of Europeans came over, but in this European construct, like you said, and these people rising to the upper classes, they specifically excluded Portuguese laborers from that. And oh yeah, you know.
It's sort of like the Japanese and the Chinese are higher up than the Filipinos and the Portuguese. That's sort of kind of like the caste system of what I kind of felt when I was a young child.
And I read that the Japanese were the largest threat, in quotes, threat to this white population. Would you say that's accurate? Or they perceived Japanese as the biggest
I guess they
threat.
Were perceived that way. But you know, this is pre-war, World War II. And during World War II, what a lot of people don't know is that there was actually an internment camp in Hawaii. I didn't even know that growing up. It had been sort of not discussed. I knew about the internment camps on the mainland, but I didn't know that there was one in Hawaii. And so obviously then all the Japanese were perceived as a giant threat. And especially if you were educated in any way, you were perceived as a giant threat.
Of course. Of course.
Yeah. Because most, you know, like most immigrants, you know, you don't know the language. If you're going to get a job, it's going to be something where you don't really need language skills. So, you know, my grandmother kept house, or, you know, everybody did maid work or, you know, yard work or worked in the fields or stuff like that.
Wow.
Chinese laundries, you know, like those kinds of industries are what most immigrants immediately go towards, because that's something they know how to do.
Yeah.
Wow. Thank you. I mean, here's the thing. If we're going back to the situation of this man being forced into confession, the thing about that is, and to your point, Anne, of like, and so what's, how has that become different over the years? It hasn't, because that shit works, because you are beating somebody almost to death. You are keeping them in probably a room for however many hours on hours until this person is just going to get into a mental place of capacity where they're saying, okay, I did it. I would probably do it too. I try and think of putting myself in that situation all the time of sitting in a room for what, 13 hours until I can finally tell somebody what they want to hear.
And we're so sassy. I can just see us now throwing our hands up in the air and going, I did it. As a joke.
Yeah, but that's
the transcript. The transcript doesn't translate our sass, right? So
no,
does not translate attitude.
Mm-hmm.
But in this particular case, Harry thankfully does not confess. He thankfully does. He gets the shit kicked out of him, which is awful. But he didn't. He wasn't forced into lying into a false confession,
right?
Which, thank God.
No, if he had confessed, he would have been killed. He would have
absolutely
been
mm-hmm. absolutely,
you know? totally.
So, you know, I told you earlier that Miles had a bit of a death wish. 2 days earlier, on September 20th, he sends an anonymous note to the Honolulu Star Bulletin, along with a bit of ransom money, just to prove that it's him. And the note said, quote, "Masgill Jameson, poor innocent lad, has departed for the unknown, a forlorn walking shadow in the great beyond, where we all go to when the time comes," unquote.
Oh, that's very cryptic. And that sounds like he wanted it for himself. That's weird.
Yeah. Well, what I read was that, I mean, I tried to read as much as I could about it, but that he did, that I said earlier that I said exact his revenge. I think a lot of people think it wasn't about the revenge, is that he wanted to die. And that this was his way to do that, you know? Anyway, also in this note was a perplexing thing regarding three kings. The note said, quote, "The three kings would reveal themselves in 5 days," but it didn't take 5 days. On this same day, September 20th, on the banks near the Alawai Canal, near the Royal Hawaiian Hotel, the search ended. The body of Gil Jameson was discovered. The body had been staged with a cross made out of sticks lying upon the small boy. Right near the body, the mystery of the three kings was revealed, as there were three playing cards, all kings, and the cards were handed over to see if there were any, you know, fingerprints. I did find a Honolulu newspaper clipping, and as a side note, my friends, there is a subheadline that referred to fingerprint clues, and clues is spelled C-L-E-W-S, and I just liked that, and I think we should all spell it and pronounce it that way from now on.
That way.
Clues.
Clues.
It's like a liquid
clue. I quite like it. Clues. Yeah. Also, in the child's hand was a bloodstained magazine clipping of Will Spencer McGannon's poem, Immortality. And the poem's opening line is, quote, "There is no death," end quote. The body was, this is like a poetic guy doing this. You know
what
I mean?
It's dark.
This is somebody who has like either an inner monologue journal in their brain happening, who's doing this kind of stuff. But anyway, the body was found by searchers who had struggled through 50 yards of brush. Anne, go ahead.
No, I mean, obviously, isn't Life's But a Walking Shadow from Macbeth? I feel like he's, he's somebody who is trying to educate himself and is very attracted to like these poetic kind of images. So, you know, obviously he's going to sort of like make it seem really cool. And I don't know.
Maybe that's where my brain is going. It's like, this seems very much like a Baz Luhrmann film. Like,
yes, I'm yes. watching somebody who's like very dramatical about
yeah. artsy. Yeah. Just an artsy.
Or like, remember, John Lennon's Killer with the Catcher in the Rye, you know, being, yes. it had to be so poetic and, you know, so meaningful. But Jessica, you said, the body was found by searchers who had struggled through 50 yards of brush. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes.
So Anne, I'm going to interject here. You and I have auditioned for many of the same roles, and I'm fairly certain that in the movie version of this story, you and I would be up for the role of searchers through 50 yards of brush.
Well, I don't Pretty know. Sure. It was 1928.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that they would have let women participate in that.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you would point. Be white, so you would be yeah. above that kind of labor. I wouldn't be, but
oh,
men would
that
have
hurts my ears.
That job.
Yeah. What? Sometimes I don't like being white, you guys, especially now. Sorry.
It's not your fault.
I'm with you, girl.
We suck.
Girl, I'm with you, girl.
Suck. Sorry, whiteies, you suck. We all suck. Anyway.
Oh, God. It really, truly. I digress.
Yes, neither one of us could have helped Gil Jameson that day. I'll just say that.
Okay.
Yeah. We couldn't help Gil, but here's the thing. News reports have said that there was absolutely no indication that the child had struggled based on, number one, the positions of his body, and number two, on the signs of whether or not there was a struggle that may have been compromised by the initial group of searchers who trampled through all of that brush.
Right.
God damn it. And Jenny, who couldn't have. Now, 2 days after that, Miles heads on a train trip to his old town of Waialua. Is that right?
Waialua, correct.
Yes. Waialua. And when he's paying for the return ticket, the ticket taker recognizes the $5 bill as part of the ransom money and gives the police a heads up. I know. How could you? That is some movie shit right there. That's pretty genius.
How would you? I have a question. How would you know that $5 bill is from the bank? Like, is it really just super crisp? Like, how would you know?
I mean, I feel like they probably did that thing where like they released the serial numbers. But who's going to remember all the serial, you know what I mean? There's like a million, there's lots.
I mean,
turns out
God
the train ticket
for this
taker.
Ticket taker. Yeah, Mr. Ticket Taker.
He's like, thanks, that's B5875431. That's the
that's
what you got.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, that's very Rain Man of him. That's very Rain Man.
Yes,
but,
yes. Maybe that's part of it. Because
It
like,
could be.
Who could possibly recall that, even if you read it in the paper or whatever, you know?
Absolutely. And then one day after, this guy, Mr. Ticket Taker, says, this is weird, dear police. One day later, they apprehend Miles and he confesses to everything. Now, he's completely guilty and no one is saying that he didn't do it. However, again, getting back to the racism of it all, norms and protocol get completely thrown out the window. Normally in Hawaii, you get a 10-day mental examination period. And here he was reviewed in 90 minutes. That's it. And his defense didn't even offer an insanity plea as a possibility. And when they did put on their side of the case during trial, they didn't call any witnesses and presented his entire defense in 19 minutes.
This is why it's better not to have a court-appointed lawyer. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying.
Yeah.
I'm completely with you on that. But I mean, 19 minutes, that is 1 minute for every year of his life. At this time, I would get 37 minutes, and Anne and Jen, you would both get 29 minutes.
That's right. That's right.
Wow. Of course, he did a horrible thing. But if the roles were reversed, I think a white man would have gotten the 10-day.
They did determine he was insane. Or at least several, a few of the doctors thought he for certain was that it met the standard, the clinical standard. Yet, this guy killed a little kid. I don't harbor any sort of real warm fuzzies for him, but
no,
you know, but when you look at the process, that should be held to a standard. No, you would hope.
Yeah,
of course. But I mean, you know, again, anytime you have somebody in a less powerful position who's done something, it's real easy to sort of railroad whatever you want to do, because you can't really like go like, that's wrong. You know, like he killed a kid. And if you can get to there, then it's just sort of like, you know, the mob mentality just goes, and it's like, yeah, and we're going to string him up, or we're going to blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
This episode is brought to you by our best friends at Spindrift. Yes, you heard me, best friends. For those who know us, you know how addicted we are to true crime and sparkling water. Cue the day when we were both starring in Broadway shows and stumbled upon the Holy Grail, Spindrift.
America's first sparkling water with real squeezed fruit. Yep, that's it. 11 flavors with no worries about any chemicals going into your body. You'll have a crush on all flavors, trust us.
Oh, and they make the perfect mixer for your holiday bevvies too. Ugh, the possibilities are endless. Just go now to drinkspindrift.com, find your match, and use our sassy sparkling code KILLIT20 at checkout and get 20% off your first order. Self-care, baby. After all, it's necessary in 2020.
And we have been flying here on Hawaiian Airlines for quite a long time. Do you need a hot towel? Can we get you anything?
Thank you so much. That's so kind of you. I would like a guava juice, please.
A guava juice,
a lickety split. Don't worry. I'm heading out and I'll grab it from the corner store.
There's this great book. Please order it, everyone, called Race to Death in 1920s Hawaii by Professor Jonathan Okamura. It just came out last year. I can't speak for the author, of course, but it was my impression that he wanted to make sure that it was important to look at all of this contextually. For example, I doubt very highly that a white citizen who killed a Japanese American at this time would have been subjected to the same atrocities that Japanese Americans were subjected to at that time. And that's the point. And Anne, you alluded to this before, but do you have any further opinion on that matter?
I think that, I mean, I obviously think Miles was, you know, that his case was affected by the fact that he was Japanese and that he killed a white child, and not just any white child, but a wealthy white child. I do sort of feel like socioeconomically, if he had killed like a poor white child, I don't know that anybody would have cared to the same extent. But because it was sort of like an affront to like the caste system in place. Mm. Does that make sense?
100.
I don't know. Also, like, I think there'd be just as much outrage if a white guy killed an Asian child. I think there's just something about like child murder that is truly, truly reprehensible and beyond the pale. Do you know?
For
what I mean?
Sure. So, for sure.
You know, what's the point of kidnapping an Asian child if their family doesn't have any money?
Yeah.
That's sort of what my dad always said to me. He's like, don't worry, you will never get kidnapped. For why?
Okay. Dad.
Thanks, Dad. Dad.
You know, but since I attended Punahou, now this is many, many years later, obviously, when they let Asians in, since I attended Punahou, you know, I had a lot of classmates who were very, very wealthy, you know, even wealthier, I think, than Gil Jameson. And they were definitely people who had had kidnap threats.
Mm, wow.
Because their families were so wealthy. And yeah, I mean, obviously, I don't know that it was right after, you know, Gil Jameson, but I'm sure I know that when we were in school, like you had to jump through a lot of hoops to get picked up early. I'll say that.
So the kidnapping and murder itself occurred on September 18th, and only 3 weeks later on October 8th, Miles was pronounced guilty and the judge also sentenced him to be hanged. And Miles actually thought he'd had a fair trial. He completely thanked the court and the jury, and he had a closing quote. He said, quote, "I hope to be forgiven by my family," unquote. That's it. And there were appeals that lasted about a year, and the community itself was torn apart, completely divided, which again, how parallel to what we are going through right now in 2020 in a lot of ways. So the community was completely divided, and Miles was executed on November 19th, 1929. He is buried in the Ann. This would be one of those places where I absolutely need your help. I think it's Mo'ilili.
Mo'ilili.
Exactly correct. And nobody should ever listen to me ever again.
And nobody should ever have to say that. It's really hard. But like, do you
it's
see how
beautiful
like,
though?
If you separate out
you
all the vowels,
say it again.
Mo'ilili.
Yeah.
You see how like if you say all the vowels kind of like separately, it's a lot easier.
Mo'ilili. Is that right? Mo'ilili.
Is that right? Is that right, Jessica?
I would say that it is. Yes, I would say M-O-I-L-I-I-L-I.
I love cemeteries anyway. That's a beautiful name.
M-O-I-L-I-I-L-I.
Yeah, Mo'ilili, yeah. Mo'ilili, yeah, that's it. Just say every single I and you'll find.
Mo'ilili.
There you go.
Okay. So I'm going to say again that Miles was executed on November 19th, 1929, and he is buried in the Mo'ilili. Anne is nodding at me. I just want you guys to know that she's nodding at me with approval. Japanese cemetery in Honolulu. And I mean, look, we've all discussed it, but we don't want to forget that the true victim in this case is young, innocent George Gil Jamison, who is buried at the Oahu Cemetery, also in Honolulu. It's always hard to do these cases about kids, which any case is hard, but Anne, you are our guest today. As a crime enthusiast, like the two of us are, is there anything else that you want to add about this type of thing or this murder specifically?
Well, it's so tragic, like on so many fronts. Like that's the thing. It's like, it's so tragic because the child died, and yet Miles is such a tragic figure to me. Because everything he's doing is sort of motivated to like elevate his family, and yet every single decision actually pushes them down further. Do you know what I mean? When, and this is true, I'm sure, of all families, but definitely in the Japanese culture, if your child does something wrong, that reflects very poorly on your entire family, doesn't it? Because you're the one responsible for raising this child. There's nothing wronger than killing someone, a child, no less. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And like that somehow in Miles's brain, he thought that like this would get him somewhere. Whereas us sort of like as rational thinkers, we're like, this is a stupid idea. Do you think you're going to get away with it? Like, it just seems like a very obvious kind of plan by somebody who hasn't thought it all the way.
It was such a shame too, because I like what you said earlier about the socioeconomic factor that you have to take in. And there were so many risk factors that this young man had. On the other hand, you had a lot of people saying, well, a lot of people had those same risk factors and they didn't choose to kill a small child.
No, of course not. You know. Right, no, of course. Exactly.
So hard.
But if there's something that clicks in your brain, like if you're a serial, you know, like if you're Charles Manson or something, somebody who has a kind of a psychopathic head, and you think that killing somebody is going to elevate your status in the world somehow, you know. And I'm like, I don't get how even like a young guy, you know, would make that mental process and go like, I know, I'll go get a little kid and kill him and ask for the money and it's going to work out. Like, to me, this is a terrible plan.
I mean, but it's amazing it's amazing what a little desperation will do. Whatever he had going on, whatever was not functioning properly, took him to a place of, oh my God, this is the only way that I'm going to be able to help my family out monetarily. And again, like, for three of us, you know, rational thinkers would not be where I would go to try and make a buck.
No. Well, it's cuckoo ca-choo. Like, there's no way he's not going to get caught at some point along the line, right? When you think about it kind of rationally. And I'm just like, what?
And that he hero worshipped Leopold and Loeb too. You know, he just looked up to them and, you know, had, I guess, aspirations of of delusions of grandeur. I don't know what, but he obviously wanted to be like these two like fellows. Them. And,
and is that just sort of like the glorification of, you know, young killers? I mean, I don't know. But it is a fact. Leopold and Loeb case is obviously also very fascinating. It's been made into projects and stuff. And there's something sort of glamorous in a way about them. So maybe that he was just sort of in that mindset and thought he would be famous or it would, I don't know what, but kind of coming from the Japanese family POV, I'm just like, how could you possibly think this would bring honor to your family? I know that you need the money and we're trying to save them from being evicted. But just like there's got to be an easier way than like, let's kill somebody. Like, you know, to me, this is just like a big, you know, disconnect. I just, how long do you think that family were like social pariahs?
Oh, the embarrassment.
I cannot even imagine. I'm sure they moved away or did something because, you know, come on, you can't stay in your town.
No way. No way. And then everybody's probably diagnosing your kid too. They're like, is it, you know, because then my brain automatically goes to, well, is there a dissociative personality disorder? There's got to be a narcissistic thing happening as far as, you know, writing these quotes out and making everything seem very grand. And like Anne said, totally romanticizing the situation of what it is. Because again, like when we read books or we read about other famous people who have gone through these types of things or are famous for these crimes, there's got to be something in his brain that went, oh man, I'm totally enamored by that. And I mean, again, I would have been like, why don't I just try to rob the bank?
Hey,
wouldn't that be your natural first step? Or let me pick a pocket.
Oh, and we truly cannot thank you enough for taking time out of your busy schedule to join us today. Thank you, thank you, thank you. We love you much.
We do love you, Anne. We really, really do. Thank you.
I love you guys, too.
You're on the podium, too. You're one of our top three guests. So thank you so much.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you again.
You're the best. I hope you're having such a fun time.
My pleasure to be here.
Yay!
I'm happy to see your faces.
I know. I was just going to read my mind. I was just going to say that. Anne, you're a trooper.
Do you know how to leave, Anne, or you're okay?
Let me see. Yes, I do know how to leave.
Okay. Oh, damn it. I don't want you to leave. Well, bye.
Bye. Thanks very much.
Well, she's just the best.
Yep, she's the greatest.
I had forgotten in the Coco Pandemois that she was so damn funny. She just is.
She just is. She's so talented. I love her voice. I could listen to Anne Harada read the phone book. Same. And everything she behind the eyes. She's just funny. I love her. And a good person too.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Crime Family.
And until next time, keep killing it.
Don't kill anyone.
Crime Fam, go to our Patreon page and join us to get exclusive bonus content. And follow us on Instagram at Killing It On Broadway and Twitter at Killing It On B-Way.
Subscribe to us wherever you download your podcasts.
And go ahead and give us a 5-star rating and lovely review. It'll be good for you.
Killing It On Broadway is a production of Killing It On Broadway, LLC.
Music by Mary Mitchell Campbell. Orchestrations, Benedict Braxton Smith.
Edited and engineered by Smokey.
Morale officers, Fred and Nelson. Say goodbye, Fred.
Say goodbye, Nelson.